Good evening. I was assigned to speak about addictions, and I wasn't really given any other instructions. So I chose the title of Helping People with Addiction. And I used a number of sources in my studies. Two that I use the most are No More Letting Go by Deborah J. and Addiction Free by Jean Hawes and Anderson Hawes. And thank you, Loyal, for sharing that scripture. I think that's a really good passage. And as he was reading that, I realized to my embarrassment that I don't really have much scripture here. I mostly used these books and some online resources. And so I wish I had a little more scripture, but I'd say if any of you think of a scripture, while I'm talking, if you think of a scripture, just raise your hand and share it with the group. Okay, I'm going to begin. Actually, I'm going to spend a lot of time in defining addiction, defining and describing the way it works. The American Society of Addiction Medicine, this is their short definition. It's only two paragraphs. Addiction is a primary chronic disease of brain reward, motivation, memory, and related circuitry. Dysfunctions in these circuits leads to characteristic biological, psychological, social, and spiritual manifestations. This is reflected in an individual pathologically pursuing reward and or relief by substance use and other behaviors. Addiction is characterized by inability to consistently abstain, impairment of behavioral control, craving, diminished recognition of significant problems with one's behaviors and interpersonal relationships, and a dysfunctional emotional response. Like other chronic diseases, addiction often involves cycles of relapse and remission. Without treatment or engagement in recovery activities, addiction is regressive and can result in disability or premature death. Did you notice the word spiritual in there? I think it's interesting that the American Society of Addiction Medicine, which I'm assuming is not a religious organization in any way, that they recognize it's a spiritual problem. Some of the characteristics of addiction are tolerance. You develop a tolerance to the thing, and you need a higher and higher dose to get your fix. Also, withdrawal symptoms. If you don't get the thing, then you have withdrawal. Also, self-deception. Addicts lie to themselves and to other people constantly. Loss of willpower and distortion of attention. Okay, now I want to define what I'm talking about when I talk about drugs. And I'm talking about recreational drugs or prescription drugs used recreationally. And that is becoming a huge problem in America in the last decade or so, specifically painkillers. Also, alcohol is a drug. You hear alcohol is legal and it's socially acceptable. So you hear people talk about drugs and alcohol in the same phrase. But let's be clear, alcohol is a drug. Now, 2 weeks ago, Paul talked about why we abstain from mind-altering substances. I believe that was the title. I don't see Paul here. Oh, there he is. Yes, okay. And thank you for sharing that, Paul. How many of you consider alcohol a recreational drug? I do. And if you think that, well, there's nothing wrong with Christians having a sip once in a while, try telling yourself that alcohol is a recreational drug. Once you make that switch in your brain, it's pretty hard to justify drinking alcohol. I really suspect that many people who drink socially without getting drunk do enjoy the buzz that it gives them. I don't know. I'm not qualified to make that judgment, but that's what I suspect. Some statistics. About 18 million Americans are alcoholics. That's about 1 in 8 who drink alcohol. About 26 million Americans each year use recreational drugs. About 5.5 million of those have become addicted badly enough to need treatment. Now, these numbers are from 2001. So I should have tried to find more current statistics. I didn't think about that until it was too late. Alcohol causes a bigger problem in this country than all other drugs combined. It's also the drug that's most damaging to the human body. Now, I do have a question about that last sentence, because I think meth is probably worse than alcohol. This may have been written back before the meth epidemic. I don't know. Deborah J., I want to quote several sentences from Deborah J. She says, "How we feel about a particular drug may or may not be relevant to how dangerous the drug is compared to other drugs. A drug prescribed by a doctor may be as addictive as a street drug, but we feel no concern about taking it." Prescription painkillers are made from the same heroin that's sold illegally on the streets. Only it's the pure stuff. The stuff you get on the streets has been diluted a number of times. So accidental addiction is a problem. People who go to the hospital, who have an injury, who really need painkillers, and then they eventually become addicted to that. And I'll have more to say about that a little later. Okay, so addiction is a disease. It's not a vice or a habit, and it's not a mental illness. It's an emotional and a spiritual illness. Now a lot of the studies I'm going to be talking about tonight were done by non-religious people, and I think their findings are really important, but I think Christians have a lot that we can add to the discussion. Okay, something about addiction is that it creates permanent changes in your brain chemistry. So addiction is a chronic disease. Once you're addicted, you're always addicted, because that once that switch has been flipped in your brain, there's no going back. Now, a recovered addict can overcome those cravings. I think eventually the cravings go away, but if they take one drink or use drugs once, that can all come back. Something I was finding in my studies is that addiction, that addicts don't have a choice. Like, addiction kind of overrides free will. Now, we believe in free will, right? I mean, that's a pretty core part of our theology, is that humans are able to choose. But I think addicts are responsible for their actions, but I do agree that addiction destroys self-control to a large extent. Those might seem like contradictory statements, but I think they're both true, which just underscores the fact that addicts need outside help. They need someone to step in and help them, because at some level they are incapable of helping themselves. Okay, I want to talk a little about dopamine. And this comes from Wikipedia. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter, a chemical released by neurons to send signals to other neurons. The brain includes several distinct dopamine pathways, one of which plays a major role in reward-motivated behavior. Most types of rewards increase the level of dopamine in the brain, and many addictive drugs increase dopamine neuronal activity. Other brain dopamine pathways are involved in motor control and in controlling the release of various hormones. Dopamine also serves many different functions throughout the body, but something interesting is that dopamine won't cross the blood-brain barrier. A doctor can give a dopamine IV to a person, I think it's sometimes given to premature babies, and it won't cross over into your brain for some reason. Okay, many types of pleasurable experiences, eating a good meal or playing a video game, increase dopamine release. So in a nutshell, dopamine makes you feel good. And all addictive drugs, directly or indirectly, affect dopamine neurotransmission. Now, there's a strong genetic component in addiction. Some people are just genetically predisposed to becoming addicted. And it apparently has to do with dopamine, because some people's dopamine receptors don't work properly, and other people have fewer receptors in their brains. And those people are more susceptible to addiction. There were some studies done in the 1930s. There were some long-term studies done in Sweden. They studied twins, and they studied children who'd been adopted. Identical twins have identical genes. And fraternal twins have some different genes. So over decades, these researchers studied twins, identical twins and fraternal twins. And they discovered a strong genetic link there. If an identical twin became an alcoholic, there was a pretty strong chance that their twin would also be an alcoholic. And they found no link in the fraternal twins who have slightly different genes. It also played a significant role in how people respond to marijuana. Some people, when they smoke marijuana, they just don't like it. But they did find a genetic link there to marijuana as well. They also studied babies who were adopted. They studied babies from alcoholic parents who were adopted by non-alcoholic couples. They were four times more likely to become alcoholic as adults than babies born to non-alcoholic parents who were raised by non-alcoholic adopted parents. Okay, and it's important to note that this genetic link is a susceptibility to alcoholism that's inherited. You don't inherit the alcoholism, the addiction. You inherit a susceptibility to it. And again, I want to stress that Every person is responsible for their own actions. Yes, Gary. You know, I didn't study that. I don't know. I didn't read anything about that.
I've read that certain drugs and so on do give impairments in this direction.
Yeah, they certainly do. Mm-hmm. So while everyone is responsible for their own actions, I think it's really important that we understand the science here because it can help us to be more sympathetic as we relate to people suffering from addictions. Okay. A while back, I saw something on Facebook, a link to an article by Johan Hari. His article is entitled that something like the cause of addiction has been discovered and it's not what you think it is. He's also given a TED Talk. His TED Talk is entitled Everything You Think About Addiction, Everything You Think You Know About Addiction is Wrong. And he raises some really good points, and I would recommend reading that article or listening to his speech. You can find that on YouTube. But I have to say I'm a little skeptical because I think his view is a little lopsided. But he does have some really good things to say. He says, and he's not a religious person, but he says that he's come to the conclusion that addictions are caused by broken relationships. Humans crave interaction with other humans. And when that breaks down, then we're more likely to turn to drugs. he points out that hospital patients are given loads of heroin, but very few of them become addicted. So there's obviously something else going on. There have been studies done with rats. So you put a rat in a cage, you give it two water bottles, you give it pure water and water laced with an addictive drug. And most rats become addicted to the drug and eventually overdose and die. Well, in 1978, the Canadian psychologist Bruce Alexander conducted a really interesting experiment. He thought, well, just one rat in a cage, it doesn't have anything else to do besides drink the drug. So he did an experiment in a big cage with 200 times the floor space of a standard cage. He put in 16 to 20 rats, and gave them lots of toys, and he gave them plain water and morphine water. Of course, they tasted the morphine water because they didn't know the difference, but they actually preferred the plain water because life was interesting. There were things to do. There were toys to play with. Rats are very sociable. There were other rats and. So they did not prefer the drug water. He took rats that were addicted to the morphine water. They'd been drinking morphine water for 57 days. He moved them into rat park, and they quit. They detoxed and they just played with the other rats. Now, okay, those are rats, not humans. And there'd be some real ethical problems with doing that study with humans. But there was something similar that occurred during the Vietnam War. In the Vietnam War, many American servicemen used heroin. About 20% of them were addicted to heroin. Now, that's the number he gives. I don't know how reliable that number is. And people were really worried about all these addicted servicemen returning back to the States. We're going to have a huge problem with all these addicts. Well, they came back to the States, and 95% of them stopped using heroin because they'd been removed from that horrible situation, and they were back with friends and family. So his conclusion is that environment plays a huge role in addiction. And Johan says he's come to realize the opposite of addiction is not sobriety, it's human connection. Okay, now it sounds like I've just contradicted everything I said before about genetics. I think both are true. I think Hari really underemphasizes the medical side of the problem. But I think Hari proposes a really good solution to the problem of addiction. Okay, now I must have been talking here about drugs, but there are a lot of other things that humans can become addicted to. There's gambling, pornography, compulsive eating, video games, social media, money, and work or success. Now, I don't have much to say about social media. Maybe it's because it steps on my own toes kind of hard. But I think Hari's argument does a good job of explaining why people are addicted to social media. Because if it's human connection that we crave, well, that kind of explains why social media is so appealing, but also why it fails to meet our needs, because you're not going to find real human connection on Facebook. Now, one thing Facebook is good for is keeping in touch with people you wouldn't see otherwise, or you wouldn't have contact with otherwise. That's one thing I like about Facebook. I don't write letters, and I usually don't call people, but I can sort of stay in touch with people on Facebook. Anyway, I do confess that I waste too much time on it. So, I've talked enough about the problem. Let's move on to how we can help people. You know, society treats addicts like criminals and outcasts. They're outcasts for society. And I really believe one of the things we have to do to help people overcome their addictions is to bring them back into society. Find some way to do that. Also, there's a common or some bad advice that people often receive is, well, you just have to wait until they hit rock bottom, because they're not going to accept help before they hit rock bottom. One of the authors that I was reading said that's terrible advice. Don't let them hit rock bottom, because they'll take their family down with them. And for some addicts, rock bottom is death, and you don't want to let it get that far. 77% of recovered alcoholics said that an intervention from a friend or relative was key to helping them recover. So one of the things we need to do if we're trying to help an addict is to set boundaries. And if you remember, if you recall, the last topic I gave was about boundaries. Boundaries define our responsibilities. For example, there's a boundary around my property. And several times during the summer, I'll go around with a shovel and a wheelbarrow digging thistles. I'm sure some of you have done the same thing. Now, the thistles on my side of the boundary, they're my thistles. They're my problem. No one else is going to dig them if I don't. But the thistles on the other side of the line, they're not my thistles. I don't have to dig those. And so boundaries can help us define what is our problem and what isn't our problem. And when we try to take on other people's problems, we can certainly cause ourselves a whole lot of grief and stress. So addicts are master manipulators. And if you're trying to help someone, you need to set very firm boundaries. One example would be never giving them money. Also, and not allowing them to rob you and your family of time. Obviously, you have to spend some time if you're going to help them, but don't let them take too much time. You need to use tough love. And at some level, you have to let people suffer the consequences of their own choices. We need to try to help them, but at some point they're responsible for their actions. And it can be really hard figuring out how to do that well. Be honest with yourself about your own limitations. Be honest about what you can do and what you can't do. Don't scold and lecture them, because addicts already suffer enough self-loathing. They don't need your help for that. But at this point, I want to say something about judging. Matthew 7:1 says, "Judge not that ye be not judged." And I think this is one of the most commonly abused and misinterpreted verses in the whole Bible. People use that as a defense, you know, hey, you're not supposed to judge me, you know, back off. Well, John 7:24 says, "Judge not according to the appearance, but judge righteous judgment." Okay, so this verse is telling us that we are supposed to judge righteous judgment. And I'm not going to go in depth on this, but I think in a nutshell, we shouldn't judge people's hearts because we can't see their hearts. We shouldn't judge their motives, but I think we can judge their actions. If they're doing something wrong, we should tell them that. I mean, we can judge that. I think God gives us the discernment to judge righteous judgment. Judge actions, but don't judge their heart, because you can't see their heart. Does anyone have a personal story they would like to share about if you've tried to help someone who's been addicted? Do you have a story or advice that you'd like to share?
I don't know if this completely applies here, but I really agree with what you said about scolding, about getting upset, and I've done those things. But Oswald Chambers has really been a help to me also in remembering that if the love of Christ constrains us, if I can do that, that frees me. But if it's only love for that person, then I get emotion involved and it drags me down.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I'm thinking of just a little of our experiences. It's not a quick fix to help somebody. Mm-hmm. You have to stay with them. And if you say it, you can scold them, you can help them by staying with them. They need somebody. And very often, we kind of get discouraged and say, what's the use? But that, to me, is as much as anything, is just to stay with them, regardless of what the outcome is.
I think it's pretty important to believe that they can change, and to give them hope. I've related to people who just said it's all over with. I blew it, and we agreed with him that it's going to take a while for people to look at you differently, but you can change, and just hanging on to that and helping them to have hope can help them to again have hope. And I think it's pretty important that we're able to give them hope.
I have a question. So those are people who know they're addicts and they say they're addicts. What about people that you're pretty sure are addicts, but they don't say they're addicts? You have any thoughts on that?
Good question. You know, at that point, it seems like you're kind of limited what you can do. Because if they don't admit they have got a problem, I'm afraid there's not a whole lot you can do at that point. Sorry, that's kind of a hopeless answer. That's all I've got off the cuff. Yeah.
Not only do they maybe not admit it, but they deny that it is. Uh-huh. This isn't an issue, but it's obvious to everybody else that it is, or a lot of other people.
Mm-hmm.
Something we have done occasionally in those situations is having a conversation with somebody that we're pretty sure, you know, the problem that is apparent is not the real problem. You know, we will sometimes say things like, we want to see you succeed. We are willing. We want to help you in whatever that means. Do you want to talk about, you know, substance abuse or things like that? To the extent that people are willing to let you into that, you can help them make progress. Mm-hmm. If they aren't willing to let you into that, then you are kind of stuck with dealing with what they're willing to talk about. And the symptoms, which is where I think some of the tough love, you know, can mm-hmm. come in, making it apparent or making it clear that you want to help heal the whole person, but you can only work with what they give you to work with.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the one thing really important to remember is that we have a God that can change hearts.
Yes.
or I don't know, yes. we're on his side. And mm-hmm. while ultimately the choice has to become from the individual who is addicted, like what Shane and some others are saying, we can show options of how to get out and hope. And we can also intercede on their behalf with God. And mm-hmm. I can testify that he can change the worst parts of ourselves. Mm-hmm. It's incredible.
mm-hmm. On the issue of people who deny their addiction, it seems to me that, and I'm not sure, I almost think that the non-drug addictions are the ones that people will tend to be in denial about more. Mm-hmm. Because they are activities that everybody else is engaging in too.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know, but it seems to me that one of the challenges that we can offer them as a test is, okay, so try doing without. You know, give it a week or a month, and see if your perspective changes on the matter.
Well, I was thinking similar things to what Stephen said. Well, we started off by acknowledging that this is a spiritual problem, and I think it's really important that we fight spiritual problems with spiritual weapons. One of the things we're discovering in our family right now in fighting for Karen's freedom is that a large percentage of the battle happens out of her presence. And spiritual battle doesn't have to happen in the presence of the people you're fighting for. It primarily actually happens out of their presence. It seems, and especially when there's not a willingness on the part of the person that's in bondage. So I think, yeah, there's good stuff. What's been said about how to interact with these people is good and necessary. But the spiritual battle also needs to be fought.
Appreciated what, yeah, thank you, all of you, for for contributing. Appreciated especially what Arthur had to say about hopelessness. That ties in really well with my next paragraph here. There's a thing called learned helplessness. That's when you become convinced that you can't change a thing. Okay, here we go with the rats again. Two scientists in 1965 found that by giving rats random, unavoidable electric shocks, they would develop learned helplessness. Then they would move them to another box with a safe zone. They would never be shocked in the safe zone, and a warning light that would come on just before the shock. And those rats wouldn't retreat to the safe zone. They would just let themselves be shocked because they had been trained that there was nothing they could do to avoid the shock. Where other rats would learn pretty quickly to move to the safe zone when that light comes on, or you're going to get shocked. Now, there was a really interesting thing done with inner city students, with illiterate inner city students. Weren't able to read. Some researchers tried teaching them to read Chinese characters. In several hours, they learned to read Chinese. But they couldn't read English. They had learned helplessness. They'd just given up. They thought they couldn't read. But they could read Chinese. So this learned helplessness is something that affects addicts, and it affects their families. They just reach the point where they give up hope. And the families of addicts need help also, just as much as the addicts themselves, because families suffer a great deal. I find Alcoholics Anonymous really interesting because they've had remarkable success in helping people overcome alcoholism. It's not a particularly religious organization, but when you join AA, you have to acknowledge a higher power. It doesn't have to be God. They use the word God, but you don't have to believe in God. You just have to believe in a higher power. So, here are the 12 steps that they go through. And they sound kind of, well, they're a little weird, kind of elementary, but I think it's instructive to study these. Okay. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to one other human being the exact nature of our wrongs. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. A couple things that jump out at me is taking personal responsibility and being honest with yourself. A number of these steps refer to honesty, you know, admitting your problem. And the last step, we tried to carry this message to others. So these recovered addicts try to help other addicts. I think that's important. Another thing that Alcoholics Anonymous stresses is you do this one day at a time. To an addict, the thought of living the rest of their life without this drug, it looks totally overwhelming. But you ask them if they could do one day. Yeah? Okay, one day looks manageable. And if one day looks too big, do it by the hour. Okay, could you stay sober for an hour? And after that, another hour. It's a day-by-day process. And some addicts go to a meeting every day. I didn't look at their policy about how often they recommend that people go to meetings. But some people go to an AA meeting every day. Now I really believe that a relationship with Jesus Christ is the best way to overcome an addiction. And I wanted to spend some time discussing this. We're just about out of time. But I caution against pushing someone to become saved before they're ready for it. I don't really feel qualified to talk about this, but I just caution that. If you're trying to help an addict, don't think that you've got to lead this person to the Lord before you know, before you can do anything to help them. Yes, certainly you do want to lead them to the Lord, but I would say don't try to push it before they're really ready for it. I don't know. Does someone have a quick thought on that? We don't have much time left. Tim. Up here.
This isn't actually very directly in response to that, but maybe kind of on the flip side, we talked about how important human interaction is to finding freedom. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how that, I guess the question that comes to me is how can we provide that for people who are still in the throes of the battle? And mm-hmm. maybe give them that human interaction, that experience of community before they're free. Sometimes it feels like maybe we demand that they be free before we give them that.
I agree.
Well, I was just thinking what you're saying at the last, I thought of what was said about Jesus and what he said about himself. We said about him that a bruised reed he will not break, and smoking flax he will not quench. I think that's, you know, that's that same principle. He went to the people in need, ministered to them, lived with them. He didn't wait for them to better themselves first. Mm. And I think the same, and I was thinking along some of the same lines that Tim was talking about, you know, that need to provide community for them to help them be able to come to healing. And part of that means we have to be willing to embrace the dirt, the things that aren't comfortable about their addiction. We have to be willing to get alongside that and experience that with them in a sense, mm-hmm. so they actually can feel that we are coming alongside them. I think Dad, when he had his topic, mentioned the alcoholic that used to come around in Belgium, and you know, that was someone that Dad that God brought into Dad's life that he befriended. And it wasn't always, it was very often not pretty. But I think God did use that as well. I think there is a sense we have to let go of our cleanness, so to speak, and be willing to join them in that hard place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On the matter of trying to bring someone to the Lord before they're ready, excuse me. I think we have tended to believe that becoming a Christian is the way to find the solution to our problems. And I think many people will be disappointed if we bring them, if we try to introduce them to the gospel, thinking that that's going to solve their problems. Mm-hmm. We have a need to worship, and I think what someone needs to understand first is that God is worthy of our worship. We bow down to Him. We worship. That's the beginning, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely. We need to be really careful that we don't tell people, oh, just accept Jesus and it'll fix all your problems. It doesn't, you're still going to have problems. I mean, it's certainly better. It's easier to confront your problems when you're walking with the Lord. But, yeah. Okay, well, I need to wrap this up. In Matthew 12, 43-45, these are the words of Jesus. When the unclean spirit is gone out of a man, he walketh through dry places, seeking rest and finding none. Then he saith, I will return into my house from whence I came out. And when he is come, he findeth it empty, swept, and garnished. Then goeth he and taketh with himself seven other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter in and dwell there, and the last state of that man is worse than the first. even so shall it be also unto this wicked generation. Now, I'm not sure I understand everything Jesus was trying to say here, but I think we can apply these verses to addictions. If you want to cast something out of your life, you need to fill your life with better things. You know, going back to what I was saying about Hari's premise that it's all about relationships and human connections. You've got to fill your life with good things. And I think that's maybe one of the biggest gifts we can offer to a friend who's trying to overcome an addiction. Yeah, just spending time with them, connecting with them, and showing them that there's something better. Okay, and now here's a quote from Johann Hari. The writer George Monbiot has called this the age of loneliness. We have created human societies here where it is easier for people to become cut off from all human connections than ever before. Bruce Alexander, the creator of Rat Park, told me that for too long we have talked exclusively about individual recovery from addiction. We need now to talk about social recovery, how we all recover together from the sickness of isolation that is sinking on us like a thick fog. And lastly, I think we really need humility. I mean, let's remember, we're all broken. We all need God. We need to approach things with humility. Okay, that's all I have to say. Thank you all for contributing. Let's have another song.